Time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. He has reported from more than 50 countries and has worked for the Christian Science Monitor, National Public Radio, the Dallas Morning News, and the New York Times, for which he was a foreign correspondent for 15 years and was awarded a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for the paper's coverage of global terrorism. He is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute in New York City and has taught at Columbia University, New York University, and Princeton University, and just finished teaching inmates at a correctional facility in New Jersey. He writes a weekly column at truthdig.com, in addition to having written numerous books, including Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, and The Triumph of Spectacle, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, Death of the Liberal Class, and his new book, co-authored with Joe Sacco, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. Chris, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
So if we could start out before talking about the book, talk about a recent development with you suing President Obama and Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta regarding the National Defense Authorization Act. Can you talk about that?
Yes, this was just one more assault, egregious assault by the Obama administration against civil liberties. I think at this point the record of the Obama administration is arguably worse than the Bush administration. Not only have they supported the FISA Amendment Act, which retroactively made legal what under our Constitution has traditionally been illegal, the warrantless wiretapping, monitoring, and eavesdropping of tens of millions of American citizens, and we now know that all our personal information is being stored in a giant supercomputer in Utah. Not only the refusal to restore habeas corpus, not only interpreting the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act to empower the executive branch to order the assassination of American citizens. I'm talking about the Yemeni cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, and then 2 weeks later his 16-year-old son. The use of the Espionage Act to shut down whistleblowers, including this CIA, former CIA official Sterling, who apparently exposed war crimes to the New York Times, and then calling in Jim Risen, who wrote the story at the New York Times, and attempting to force him to expose his sources. I mean, this is just unconscionable, and this what was added to this was the decision by the president on New Year's Eve to sign into law the National Defense Authorization Act, which included Section 1021. Section 1021 of that act empowers the government to use the military to seize American citizens off of U.S. soil, hold them in military facilities, including our offshore penal colonies, strip them of due process. And these are not just people, by the way, who may, in the judgment of intelligence officials, have relationships, direct relationships with terrorist groups, but can have relationships with what, in the nebulous language of this section, are called associated forces. And these people can be held in the language of this section of the NDAA until the end of hostilities, which in an age of permanent war is ever. It's just indefinite detention by the military without access to the basic constitutional right of due process. It's a staggering assault on civil liberties. Dianne Feinstein, when the bill was co-sponsored by Carl Levin and John McCain, proposed inserting language to exempt American citizens from this. This was rejected by both the Obama White House and the Democratic Party. And so I sued the president and the defense secretary, was eventually joined by a few other plaintiffs, including Daniel Ellsberg, and Judge Catherine Forrest of the Southern District Court of New York ruled in our favor and issued a temporary injunction against that section of the NDA, in essence invalidating the law. We are now waiting to see the government response. There will be final briefs filed, I think, in August, and then government lawyers have 60 days by which they can file an appeal. And at that point, it would, if they do appeal, it would go to the appellate court. And then if the appellate court upholds it and they appeal again, it would go to the Supreme Court.
And do you have significant financial burdens from doing this case?
No. The lawyers worked pro bono, Carl Mayer and Bruce Afron. We all paid, we just paid our own expenses. So the expenses, because the lawyers were working pro bono, the expenses were marginal. But of course, you know, I think for me what was so disturbing is I kept asking myself, where are the 1 million lawyers in this country? Where are the deans of law schools? Where are all those people who are tasked with defending the Constitution? Why aren't they out here with us?
So talk a bit about your latest book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. What was the motivation in?
Well, it's a look at the sacrifice zones, those places within the country that have been offered up to unfettered capitalism, to the marketplace, where there are no impediments to what corporate profiteers want. We began with Pine Ridge, which of course is where it all started, the seizure of Native American land by railroad barons and timber companies and gold speculators, who of course in the process carried out egregious acts of genocide. That whole sort of demented project of exploiting human beings and the natural world until exhaustion or collapse took place on the western plains. And of course, that whole concept of manifest destiny, which is that God has given the Anglo-Saxon race the right to seize for themselves resources, land, and push aside any impediments, including human beings who stand in their way. Once westward expansion was complete, that imperial project went first to the Philippines, into Central America. I mean, it of course is continuing to this day in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think what's also important about that moment in history is that it didn't just seize land, exploit, and often exhaust resources from buffalo herds to virgin timber, but it destroyed a competing ethic, another way to relate to the natural world and relate to each other. In native societies, people who hoarded goods for themselves were despised. Everything was communal. And Marx and Engels, when they write on communism, interestingly enough, look very, very closely at the social and political structures of the Iroquois Indians. And I think in some ways that sort of project of unfettered capitalist expansion couldn't subsist with that competing ethic. And now that whole project is crashing down upon us, that these sacrifice zones, we go on and look at our former manufacturing centers in Camden, New Jersey in particular, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States and not surprisingly one of the most dangerous. The coal fields of southern West Virginia, where we are allowing coal companies to literally destroy the Appalachian mountain range by blowing the top 400 feet off of mountains, leaving behind a vast wasteland. We flew over it, hundreds of thousands of acres. It's just insane because these coal companies, to save money, don't want to dig down as they did in the past to extract the coal. They will just destroy the mountains, expose the coal seams, use some of the largest land equipment on earth, 25-story drag lines, giant bulldozers. And one of the things they do is they use these massive machines to push the topsoil and the forests over the sides of the mountains, and then they burn them. So we're flying over the Appalachians, and we're seeing these man-made fires where they're just burning off the forests. And there's nothing left behind. Now, they poison the water, the air, the soil. They leave these gigantic billion-gallon toxic impoundment ponds filled with heavy metals, which occasionally burst. It is just a perfect window of how we, of course, across the planet, have allowed corporate power to determine our relationship to the ecosystem that sustains the human species. And in theological terms, these corporations are systems of death. They are not about preserving, nurturing, or protecting life, including the environment that makes life for us possible. And that's why the environmental crisis is intimately twinned with the economic crisis. We also go into the produce fields of the country where undocumented workers are often treated literally like slaves, held against their will in debt peonage, sometimes behind barbed wire, forced to work, told that if they report the abuse to authorities, their families in Mexico or Honduras or Guatemala will be harmed. As Bernie Sanders says of Immokalee, where we were in the race to the bottom that has become America, Immokalee is the bottom. And that is the perfect worker in the eyes of the corporate state. What we are creating nationally as well as globally with globalization is a form of neo-feudalism, a world of masters and serfs where workers are told that in order to be competitive in a global marketplace, they are going to have to be competitive with the prison labor in China or sweatshop workers in Bangladesh who make 22 cents an hour. That's what's being created. These corporations are supranational. They have no loyalty to the nation state. They are quite willing to hollow the country out from the inside, which they're doing. The signs of physical decay are everywhere. Collapsing infrastructure, closing public schools, closing libraries, closing fire departments, and then the long-term suffering that is being visited on the working and increasingly the middle class. Roughly 20% of Americans are either underemployed, seriously underemployed, or unemployed. And the corporate state knows one word, which is more. There are no limits, and some great political theorists, including Karl Marx, have written about this, that unfettered capitalism is a revolutionary force. Carl Pugliani, an economist, in 1944, wrote a book about unfettered capitalism called The Great Transformation, in which he noted that quality of commodifying everything, commodifying human beings, commodifying the natural world. And he actually, although he is an economist, writes that when a society loses the capacity for the sacred, when nothing has an intrinsic value but simply a monetary value, then built into that system is a quality of collective suicide, because you know no limits. And that is precisely where we are, as anyone who reads climate change reports, as I do. Nature magazine this month had a very terrifying piece where they interviewed 16 of the top climate scientists who talked about global, worldwide, catastrophic, ecological collapse. And if we don't wrest power back from these corporations, which in essence have carried out a kind of corporate coup d'etat in this country in slow motion, they'll kill us, quite literally. We end with the Occupy movement. The book was always, which we worked on for 2 years, and I should say Joe Sacco drew out 50 pages of illustrations, including comic panels, which give a kind of filmic quality to many of the lives of the people we interviewed. We ended with Zuccotti, but we didn't anticipate Zuccotti. We knew the book was going to be called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, because with all restraints lifted against corporate power, the predatory nature of corporate capitalism, we were certain there would be a backlash, but we didn't know what it would look like. We didn't know when it would arise. We didn't know where it would arise. And then September 17th happened in New York City. So the last chapter is this look at this attempt to rationally respond. I mean, I was on Democracy Now! In New York a couple weeks ago, and after I finished with Amy, Paul Krugman was on. And I like Krugman. I read his stuff. But when the show was finished, you know, he's constantly calling for a rational response to the economic crisis, which would, of course, include a massive jobs program. These aren't his words, but mine, a forgiveness of student debt, a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, and a rational health plan, which is not Obamacare, that would in essence provide Medicare for all. And I said, Paul, well, of course, all the points you make, but it assumes that the power structure is capable of responding rationally. It's interesting to me, his response was, well, given climate change, none of this matters anyway. So I think that when we look at the structures of power, we find that because they are utterly beholden to corporate interests, I think Citizens United, the 2010 ruling, sort of snuffed out what was left of our anemic democracy. All of our legislation, including Obamacare, written by corporate lobbyists. Our laws at this point serve the interests of corporations. The assault against the poor and the working class and the middle class is unchecked, so that even just in the last few weeks, we saw unemployment benefits ended for hundreds of thousands of Americans, which of course means many will lose their homes. We saw the Supreme Court strike a devastating blow against public sector unions. So I am certain that there will be a response. I don't know what it will look like. I covered movements and revolutions and insurgencies around the world, Eastern Europe, the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic, the two Palestinian uprisings or intifadas. And I learned that these forces have a kind of mysterious quality, but the engine that drives popular unrest is the actions of the ruling elite, of the ruling class. And because they have not responded to the legitimate grievances and sufferings of American citizens, tens of millions of American citizens, then I am utterly certain that we've not seen the end of this. Will it be called Occupy? Will it look like Occupy? I don't know. And we are not immune to seeing this backlash become a very frightening right-wing backlash. The right-wing populism of the 1930s, created some very frightening and deformed movements. And in essence, what we live with is a political system that has become utterly paralyzed. It doesn't function in a sense that it doesn't function on behalf of the citizenry, and that doesn't matter whether it's Republican or Democrat. And that's a very perilous state to be in. I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, and it was that political paralysis, that inability on the part of the traditional elites to cope with a deteriorating economic situation. And the war in Yugoslavia was not caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. It was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia, led to the vomiting up of some very frightening people, Radovan Karadzic in Bosnia, and Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia, and Franjo Tuđman in Croatia. And we could very well see, especially with the global financial community once again teetering on the brink of collapse, some very terrifying distortions. I mean, the Tea Party, which channels, I think, a legitimate rage and a legitimate sense of betrayal, focuses that anger, in the way fascist movements do, on the most vulnerable rather than on the elites. And it is bankrolled by, I think, the most retrograde forces in American society, including the Koch brothers and others. And that's exactly what happened with the Nazi Party. It was bankrolled by the German industrialists. Germany's problems were the fault of homosexuals and Jews and gypsies and the mentally ill and liberals in Berlin and intellectuals. And the Tea Party, like all fascist movements, speaks in the language of violence, celebrates the gun culture, targets the weak and the vulnerable, in this case Muslims, undocumented workers, feminists, again homosexuals, intellectuals, liberals, they have a long list, feminists. And I don't take movements like that lightly, however much we may laugh them off. Because I know that when societies disintegrate, And there is a widespread revulsion at traditional structures of power. There are always very large elements within that society who seek vengeance, and they seek that vengeance through movements like that. So one of the reasons I have been such an active supporter of the Occupy movement is because I don't want to see us go the other way. And, of course, I want our resistance to be nonviolent. I've been very critical of the Black Bloc. I mean, clearly the state was taken aback by the widespread support of Occupy. The goal of the state is to marginalize or sever that movement, what's left of it, from the mainstream. And the Occupy was a mainstream movement. It articulated the concerns of mainstream Americans often across the political spectrum. I mean, nobody wants the bailouts. Nobody wants the FISA Reform Act. It's just the corporations that want it. So they want to demonize the movement. And I think these Black Bloc anarchists who run around throwing bricks through windows and taunting the police are sort of a godsend to the state, which is why probably they're significantly infiltrated as well. So they use that to frighten the mainstream away from the movement, and then they want to funnel that energy back into a dead political system, which is why you get figures like Van Jones and Rebuild the Dream. I mean, I think we should look at Wisconsin as a kind of case study of what we shouldn't do. Wisconsin could have gone either way, a general strike or a recall. Unfortunately, they chose the wrong option, which was a recall. And they got a bankrupt Democratic Party to cough up a tepid rerun candidate who was not at all fervent or passionate behind the issues that pushed people into the streets of Madison. And then, of course, they just got buried under mountains of money, and they lost. And it's going to be very hard for them to reconstitute that movement. I think, you know, at this point, all energy should be spent on building movements. Movements in American history have been the true correctives to our democracy, whether that's the Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists who fought for women's rights, the labor movement, the civil rights movement. And without a functioning liberal class, in essence, that kind of safety valve that within a capitalist democracy makes incremental and piecemeal reform possible, movements are all we have left. I mean, when Conrad Black writes his biography of Roosevelt, he says that Roosevelt's greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And I think that's correct. But we no longer have functioning liberal institutions. I spend a long time in death, although my book, Death of the Liberal Class, speaking about this. And that means for those of us who care about protecting the open society, civil disobedience is all we have left.
You, at last night's talk, you spoke of Boeing, which was one of the co-sponsors, and said they needed to be, A, they needed to be sent a copy of your talk, and B, that if you had if you lived in Seattle, you would have considered protesting in front of Boeing instead of Goldman Sachs. How critical do you see it to local citizens doing things like that?
Well, it's absolutely critical because if we don't do stuff like that, we can't even use the word hope. I'm not naive enough to tell you it's going to work. But we have to begin to build mass movements very, very quickly. Because we don't have any time left. Both in terms of climate change and in terms of the precipice by which we face economically. I mean, we allowed financial speculators to loot the U.S. Treasury and go right back to gambling. And we're already watching now the cracks. Not only are banks in dire trouble in Europe with, you know, of course, massive bailouts, but we are seeing, again, J.P. Morgan Chase gambling and losing $9 billion at least. And, you know, writers who know more about this than I do, like Gretchen Morgenson at the New York Times, are running around saying, it's coming, it's coming. It's going to happen all over again, only this time it's going to be worse. The last word in Paul Krugman's column the other day was doom. He's talking about the triggering of the Great Depression. He sees nothing to stop it. And once that happens, it will create political instability. Economic instability creates political instability. And I don't want to live in a world where undocumented workers are beaten up on the street, or Muslims are terrorized, or homosexuals are harassed and the victims of widespread hate crimes. And that's not the world I want to raise my children in. And I think for those of us who care about a world for everyone, a world of mutual respect, a world where we put our resources towards, in biblical terms, helping our neighbor, it's incumbent upon us to stop being passive and complacent. Because we live in an age, as Yeats wrote, where the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity.
So in terms of nonviolence, clearly direct action and nonviolence are not exclusive.
Well, I engage in all sorts of direct action. I was arrested in front of Goldman Sachs. I've been arrested in front of the White House. I think many of the moral voices in this country that I respect have also come to the conclusion that civil disobedience is the only weapon we have left. That would include Cornel West, Wendell Berry, 77 years old, occupies the governor's office in Kentucky to protest mountaintop removal, and says before he goes in, frankly, going to jail is more time than I care to donate to the U.S. government, but it's all we have. And I think that the corruption within the centers of power is probably far more widespread than we realize. When I watched or covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe, I saw how massive, peaceful, nonviolent demonstrations were able to bring down the most efficient police state in Eastern Europe, which was the Stasi East German state. And what happened was that when protesters started pulling 70,000 people in the city of Leipzig, which is where the protests began, the Communist Party chief, Erich Honecker, who had been in power for 18 years, sent down an elite paratroop division to fire on the crowd, and they didn't fire on the crowd. And at that point, Honecker was able to hang on to power for another week. People forget that the Russian Revolution was a nonviolent revolution. The violence came afterwards with the Western powers building the White Army, creating the Civil War, with Lenin and the Bolsheviks carrying out an armed putsch to overthrow Kerensky and the Constitutional Assembly. We know when what broke the Tsar was when the Petrograd bread riots, they sent the Cossacks in to restore order, and the Cossacks not only did not fire in the crowd but started fraternizing with the demonstrators. And I think we, you know, this is a movement, you know, that sort of tag of the 99% is correct. This is a movement that articulates the concerns of the 99%, and police officers in blue uniform are not part of the 1%. I think that whatever they do, and I have seen them do some acts that I feel are egregious and wrong, you want to treat them with respect. They may not always treat us as human beings, but we want to retain our own dignity as human beings. That moment when those women are pepper sprayed, that first week in New York, seated on a sidewalk, if you watch the YouTube video, you'll hear one of the police officers say about his superior in the white shirt who pepper sprays them, "I can't believe he just pepper sprayed those women." And that's a very telling moment. If they were throwing bricks and cursing the police, he wouldn't have had any sympathy. You want to create that empathy. You want to essentially draw those forces within the pillars of power towards you, because that creates paralysis within those pillars of power. That is the most effective tactic, and that is why I've been fiercely critical of the Black Bloc in my mind, essentially playing into the hands of the security and surveillance state.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Again, we've just been talking with Chris Hedges. He is co-author of the new book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, and you can catch his weekly columns at truthdig.com. They come out every Monday.